Well, on Christ the solid rock I stand. That's really the tone of the whole letter of Jude, because as Jude writes, he's writing about the amazing salvation that we have in Jesus, and he talks about that really, really concisely. And if you look at the letter of Jude, and we're going to study it some more next week, as you read through most of the letter, it's pretty full on. It's very strong. He is really fired up about something. And what he's fired up about is the fact that there are some false teachers who are influencing people away from Christ the precious rock. They're corrupting their faith, and Jude is really stirred up about it, because our faith in Jesus, our awareness, our understanding, our experience of all he's done for us is so incredibly precious. And when people try to steal that from us, that's a big deal, and we want to be on our guard for it. So the letter is very strong in tone, but we're going to not deal with that big middle portion of the text today. We're just going to stick with the very beginning and the very end. So I invite you to turn to Jude, and we're going to start our explanation in verse 1, where it says simply this: Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ and brother of James. Now, I love the way that Jude is really simple in the way he opens this letter. A lot of letters in the New Testament open with, for example, Ephesians, to the saints in Ephesus. Okay, so it's addressed to a particular group of people in a specific place. Others, like the letter that James wrote, who was Jude's brother, he said to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations. So again, there's a particular ethnic group in mind. When Jude says, this is this is who I'm writing to, he actually goes into a little bit more detail. But before he talks about who he's writing to, he identifies himself as the one who is writing to them. And how does he identify himself? He identifies himself as Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ and a brother of James. You know who James was? Yes, there was a disciple called James. James is a fairly common name. This James being referred to is the James who was very prominent and who lived a bit longer than the other James, who was martyred reasonably early on. This James continued to be a significant leader in the church and in the church in Jerusalem. He was very well known, very widely respected. He's the guy who wrote the letter of James. So James was very well known, and Jude identifies himself by saying, I'm the guy Jude, because again, Jude was a common name, who is the brother of James, who you all know is a leader in the church in Jerusalem. You know, the interesting thing about James, he was the brother of Jesus. All right, so, and Jude is the brother of James, so what does that make Jude? Brother of Jesus. But he doesn't sort of big note himself and say, hey, it's Jude here, you remember me? I'm Jesus' brother. You know, literally, brother, same mother, half-brother if you want to be technical, but you know, I've got these family connections, I'm very important because of who my brother is. No, he just says, I'm a servant of Jesus, and so you can know who I am and where I fit in the picture of things, I'm James's brother. Oh, that Jude, cool. Okay, so he just introduces himself very humbly, very briefly, but he gets into where he gets more flowery, where he gets more descriptive, where he gets more passionate is when he describes who he's writing to. And as I said earlier, he's not identifying his audience as the people who live in this place or a particular ethnic group that's spread all over. He uses three phrases to describe the people who are going to be reading this letter, the people who need to be on their guard against having their faith corrupted. And as he describes what a Christian is using these three phrases, you get a sense of how amazing it is that God has called us to himself, how amazing it is that he has loved us, how amazing it is that he keeps us. Those are the three things that Jude chooses to identify us with. Those are the terms. Those are the precious things that he wants to guard. And why are those things so precious? We're going to spend a bit of time this afternoon just thinking about when Jude chose to identify his readers. Why did he choose the word called? Why did he choose the phrase loved by God the Father? Why did he call us as people who are kept? I'm going to start off with called. What does it mean to be called? Who remembers a guy by the name of Levi in the New Testament? He's found in Luke 5 and in other places. Let me read to you the story of how Levi was called. And this is a great illustration of what Jude has in mind of our experience too. He wants us to understand being called in the same kind of way that Levi was called. It says this in Luke 5 and verse 27. After this, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector by the name of Levi sitting at his tax booth. Follow me, Jesus said to him, and Levi got up, left everything and followed him. Really straightforward, right? Jesus comes along and calls, and Levi gets up and follows. But you know the thing I love about the story of Levi's call? It was so controversial. It was so unexpected. It was just so amazingly gracious. You see, Jesus, as an emerging rabbi, somebody who was fairly fresh onto the scene, he was travelling around, he was a teacher of the law. That was what people went to a rabbi for. How should we live? What should we do in this situation? What does the law say? And what's the understanding among the rabbis of how we should best live that out? And so rabbis would travel around and they would give people judgments, verdicts on how they should live, very, very specifically. And the job of the rabbi wasn't just to take that on himself, but he was to train others who would be able to do the same. Very similar to what we would call discipleship. You know, in 2 Timothy 2:2, Paul says to Timothy, the things that you've heard me say in the presence of many others, entrust to reliable men who will also be able to teach others. What you've got and what you're teaching, make sure you entrust it to some other people who will also be able to teach. And that way we multiply and multiply the work that God is doing through us. And that was what a rabbi did. He found reliable people so that as well as going around and teaching the masses, he really invested in a few, made sure that some people really got it, and then they were going to be the ones who would continue that ministry and expand that ministry. And so what sort of person would you look for as a rabbi? You'd look for somebody who was diligent in studying the Torah. You'd look for somebody who was interested in God's law, who memorized it like all students should, who not only memorized the law, but would also memorize different interpretations of it, the ways that it had been applied throughout the centuries. So when somebody came to them with a question, they were able to say, this is what you should do in that situation. And so Jesus, as somebody who's on the lookout for people who he can reproduce himself in, people who will be the moral guardians, people who will be the teachers of the law, who does he pick? Well, a tax collector, obviously. I mean, just no sense in that at all. Who was a tax collector? Well, a tax collector was a guy who had sold out his nation. Remember, they were under the control of the Romans. They were under an oppressive government. And all this government cared about was the empire as a whole. They didn't care about the God of the Jews, and they didn't care about Jewish people obeying the laws of their Jewish God. They didn't overly get concerned about the culture of the Jews and their religion. All they cared about was the good of their empire and the peaceful conduct of their empire. And so they would have people gathering taxes, and they didn't care too much about whether these people skimmed some off the top. In fact, that was pretty much taken for granted. What they cared about was that these people didn't take so much off the top that the population grew restless and started, you know, rioting and trying to revolt and that kind of thing. So the tax collectors, as long as they didn't steal too much, they were okay. They could do pretty much anything. And so what would happen in that society was people who were not loyal to their own country, they would bid for the right to become tax collectors. And if they won the contract, then what they needed to do was recoup the money that they'd spent in order to get the job of being a tax collector. So they would collect the mandatory taxes and send them off to Rome. And they would also collect stuff on top of that for themselves so that they could earn an income. However, most of these people weren't concerned with just getting enough to get by. They saw this as a great opportunity. We've got the might of Rome behind us. And we can say to people, pay up, and people will have to pay up. And so they were extorting the people. And of course, naturally, most of the other Jews, they just hated these people who had sold them out, who were profiting from their oppression. They were traitors. They were not concerned about obeying the law of God. They were not concerned with protecting the people of God. They were in it for themselves. But you know the amazing irony? What was his name again? Levi, right? You know, Levi is from the tribe Levi. He's named after the tribe. And you know what was interesting about the tribe Levi? You know, that's where the priests came from, wasn't it, in Old Testament times. That they had a special role in helping the whole nation worship God. You know how they got that job? Well, go way back to the Exodus. Go way back to Mount Sinai, Moses up on the mountain, he's getting the Ten Commandments, he's spending time with God, Joshua's up there nearby, keeping watch, and the rest of the people down below, after a while, they say, man, we've been here a while. God's maybe abandoned us, and Moses hasn't come back. What's gone wrong? And so what do? They turn to their old ways, and they make themselves a golden calf, and they start to worship it, and they have this huge kind of orgy of pagan worship. And Moses, as he's on his way back down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, he hears this noise, and Joshua hears it too, and he goes, there's war! And Moses goes, no, that's not the sound of battle, Joshua. Something very different's going on. And he gets back and he discovers this mayhem as people have forsaken God and they're worshipping pagan gods. They're worshipping an idol made of gold. And Moses, as part of dealing that, says, okay, all you who are for the Lord, rally to me. And guess who comes? It's the tribe of Levi. And that's where they got their position as being that special tribe set apart to lead in the worship of Israel. When all of Israel abandoned God so quickly, they were the ones who rallied and said, no, we will stand for the Lord. And so you've got this guy, Levi, and he's named after that tribe who, faced with the temptation to turn away and worship other things, they rallied to the Lord. He's done the complete opposite. He said, well, faced with the opportunity to get gold, I'm going for that. I'm going to serve lesser things. The worship of God, the good of my people, that's not what matters most to me. I'm in it for me. And he had a whole bunch of friends who were similarly minded. And they were living it up. I mean, they had heaps of money. They had complete freedom. They weren't concerned about old-fashioned religious laws. They could do whatever they want. Them and their friends, they had the money, they had the opportunity just to live it up and take life easy. And so Jesus, as he's looking for somebody who's going to be a moral guardian, somebody who'll point others to God, somebody who will look out for the well-being of their nation, obviously chooses Levi. Well, you can understand why the religious leaders were just going, what are you doing? What are you doing with that? And they grumbled and they complained, and it was a constant theme through the Gospels. Jesus, you're meant to be looking after the nation. You're meant to be choosing good people to help make more people good. You seem to be investing yourself in the wrong people. And this drama continues to unfold until you get right up to Luke 15. 10 chapters later, and these guys have continued to complain any time Jesus spends time with the wrong crowd. The Pharisees are always saying, what are you doing? They don't deserve your attention. They don't deserve God's blessing. You need to be looking out for the right people. And Jesus tells three stories in Luke 15 as once again they are muttering among themselves saying, what are you doing? And you might know those stories pretty well. It starts off with the lost sheep. Right, you all know the story of the lost sheep. You've got this shepherd who discovers that he's got a missing sheep. He counts them off at night. He's got 99 safely back in the pen. One has become lost. And so what does he do? He goes and searches and he finds that lost sheep and he carries it home and he says to his mates, hey, rejoice with me. I found this lost sheep. It's fantastic. And the interesting thing about sheep and how they become lost is, you know, I've worked a little bit with sheep, and some of you guys have as well, and sheep have never struck me as particularly brave or adventurous. You know, I don't see a sheep looking to the horizon, thinking to himself, you know what? Bears probably live up there. There might be the odd mountain lion. If they're in Australia, oh, I think there's dingoes over that way. And sheep don't tend to say for themselves, I might just go check them out. Yeah, I might just go see what kind of fun I can have over there. And off they go, all bold. Now, sheep tend to like to hang together. And what are sheep most concerned about? Eating. Similar to me in that respect. So their heads are down and they're nibbling at grass, right? And so I can just imagine this sheep, and he's got his head down and he's nibbling at grass, and he sees a tuft here and he nibbles there. He sees a tuft there and he nibbles over there, and he sees a tuft over here and he just keeps moving. And then he looks up and he goes, where am I? How did I get here? And that describes the story of so many people I know. We're moving from one thing to the next. How do I get my desires satisfied? What is it that I need? And they move from this thing to that thing, and then that runs out, and they move to this thing, and that runs out, and they move over to here, and all of a sudden they look up and go, I don't like where I am. I don't like what my life is like, and I don't know what I can do about it. I am lost. I think it's a really common experience. And what does God do as the good shepherd? He doesn't say, well, you made your bed, you lie in it. Now, you want to wander off from me? Fine, you've made your choice. No, he goes and searches. And when he brings the sheep back, what does he do? He rejoices. Jesus tells that story, getting a point through of why he has gone to look after people who, perhaps like Levi, are thinking, money will satisfy, partying will satisfy, having friends who think similarly to me and have a good time, don't need to think about all those righteous people, that'll keep me happy. And they've wandered off and they need somebody to carry them back. So he tells the story of the lost sheep, trying to get his point across. Somebody's got to go after these people and bring them back. They can't do it by themselves. And the next story he tells is of a coin, and there's a set of 10. One goes missing. This lady has 9 left. And so what does she do? Ah, 9's still pretty good. Can do a lot with that. No, she goes hunting for the lost coin, and she sweeps the house and she tidies up until she finds it. And when she finds it, she rejoices. And you know what really strikes me about a coin? You think a sheep lost in the wilderness is helpless? Imagine a coin stuck in a floorboard or under a bed or under a cupboard somewhere. A coin doesn't jump up and say, here I am! Look! A coin doesn't sort of manage to glimmer, just turn itself to catch the sun. you should see that. A coin doesn't flip itself up on its edge and roll its way back to the rest of the coins. A coin is completely inanimate. It's hopeless. It has no way of rejoining the others. It's wherever it is, and that's just that. It needs somebody to come and find it and say, there you go, pick it up, and to take it back where it belongs. And Jesus is using that as a picture of what people are like who are lost. They actually need God to come and find them wherever they may be, carry them back. And what's God's attitude when he does that? Stupid coin. I'm not even going to spend you. You're in the doghouse. You can go up there. No, he takes it back and he celebrates. What's his attitude toward the sheep? Stupid sheep. He's going to run off. Go sit in the corner of the pen. No, he brings the sheep back and says to his friends, let's have a party. Found my sheep. Obviously, the sheep matters to him. And why does he feel that way? Why does he go to all the effort? And who was I talking to lately about sheep? I can't remember. Anyway, we were talking about what it's like to carry a sheep. And if you've ever had to carry a sheep, it's not the world's most fun activity. Sheep, they tend to be awkward. I imagine Jesus would have had to have it on his shoulders. He possibly would have tied up the legs, would have been around his head, stifling with all the wool and kicking with it. So, I mean, sheep are not cooperative, even when you're trying to help them. It wasn't easy or convenient. It wasn't easy or convenient for that lady to spend a day cleaning her house. I mean, who'd want to do that? Not me. But he loves to search and find things that are precious to him. And Jesus is saying, you're looking at people like Levi and like all these sinners that I'm hanging around with, and you don't give a rip about them. In fact, you see them as blots on our society. God sees those people as being precious, and he wants to find them. He will go to the effort to find them, to pick them up, and to carry them home where they belong. There's something of the heart of God. And so when Jude opens his letter and he says, to those who are called, he's reminding us that we didn't save ourselves. We didn't find ourselves. God called us. If we have responded, it's because he first called. If you've confessed your sin to God in order to receive forgiveness, the whole reason you were able to do that is because he first convicted you that it was there. If you've believed in who Jesus is and what he's done for you and what he will do, the whole reason you're able to believe is because he first made the lights come on for you and helped you to understand, and of course it makes sense. God is the one who calls us. He takes the initiative. And why does he do it? Well, the third story that Jesus told in Luke 15 is a beautiful glimpse into the heart of God. And it's a favourite story for so many people. It's the story of the lost son. And you know it well. It's this son who's just a complete scumbag of a son. Tim's not ever going to do this to his dad. The son comes to his dad and says, Dad, I don't want a relationship with you. I don't want to live with you. I don't want to obey your rules. In fact, I would be happier not being around you. What I want from you is your stuff. It's almost what humanity has done from God, where we say, love the world, love all the resources, love the things that you've provided for us. Now, take off. We want to do what we want with it. You know, it's just that rejection of the Father. All we care about is what we can get from him. And that's what this son does. He says, give me what I want, what's coming to me. And the Father, amazingly, very graciously, does that. Isn't it amazing how gracious God is in that even though people reject him, he still sustains the universe. He still causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust, as the Bible says. He still gives people the things that they need and the things that they want, even though they're rejecting him. God's amazing that way. And the father in the story does that for the son. He provides for the son. And the son goes off, and what does he do? He just indulges all of the desires inside him, and he lives recklessly and foolishly. And then a famine comes into the country that he's in, and he just doesn't have any reserves left. And he's left impoverished, and he's left a bit like that lost sheep going, I don't like where I am, but what do I do about that? And he decides to go back, and what does he expect to get from the father? Not much. I mean, look at what he's done. He was a jerk. He doesn't deserve anything, but he's hoping. And he obviously knows the heart of his father to an extent. He's hoping that at least he'll get a job. And maybe he can earn his way into at least getting something from the father. If he works hard for him, he'll at least get a wage. And so he's thinking, well, I've blown the sonship thing, but maybe I can work towards something from God. Anything's got to be better than what I've got right now. So back he goes, and of course you remember what God does. As the father figure in the story, no care for what was normal in those days in terms of maintaining that kind of dignity of the patriarch of the family. He just picks up his robes and he runs, and he embraces his son, and he welcomes him back as a son. And the son confesses, and the father says, well, you haven't lost your sonship. come in. Let's kill the fatted calf. Let's put a ring on his finger. Let's put new clothes on him. Let's remind him of who he is. He is my son. And regardless of what he's done, he has not lost that because I still love him. And that's that second word that Jude uses. We are called. Why are we called? Because God loves. It's not because we deserve it. Same as Levi. It's because God loves. Okay, so the son comes back and he's experienced this love from God the Father beyond what he deserves. And what does the older son do? He cannot handle it. And I'd love to know what was going on in his heart as he comes back, as he sees the celebration and he finds out, well, your brother's returned and your father's throwing this party, and he gets really indignant and says, how dare my father do this? Why does he feel that way? Maybe he's got the same problem as the younger son. Maybe what he most cares about is getting what he thinks he deserves from the father. And he deserves to be treated well, and he deserves the celebration. He deserves the fatted calf and the ring and the new clothes and the party. This son deserves nothing. Why is he getting it? Maybe he just can't get over that God should treat us as we deserve idea. Or maybe he's also got a hunger for the love of God, and he's not that confident that God loves him in the same way. And he sees the love lavished upon the younger son, and maybe he's going, oh, I wonder if the father feels that way about me. I mean, I've been here all this time working hard. I mean, maybe there's a question there for him. Anyway, the father comes out and he affirms his love for the older son. He says, man, your brother was lost and I love him. So why shouldn't I welcome him back into our family? We should celebrate and be happy. But don't forget, I love you too. And everything I have is yours. And I want you to come in. And I want you to be a part of this celebration and to share my heart and to know my love and to rejoice in the relationship that we have as a father and a son together, just enjoying one another and the reuniting of each other that we can experience. And you know, the story finishes and we don't hear what the older son's response was. We don't know whether he finally understood that the love of the father for him didn't depend on him faithfully working all those years. The father loved him just because the father loved him. And by faithfully staying with the father, he saved himself from a lot of pain. I mean, no one would want to go through what the younger son went through. Yeah, he thought he was living it up, but eventually found out, no, that was a road to destruction. That was a terrible life. And so while it might have seemed attractive, it was nothing. So the older son was spared from that. Praise God. He was spared from misleading others, leading others astray, being a bad example to others. He was spared so much grief. But the fact that he stayed close and didn't do those things isn't the reason God loved him. God loved him just because God loves. And that's why Jesus says we're called and we're loved. We don't have to deserve it. We just have it. And by obeying God and staying close to him, we spare ourselves a lot of grief. And we spare others a lot of grief too. But that's not how we earn God's love, because you don't earn God's love. You just have it. That's kind of cool, isn't it? I think that's pretty amazing. I want to tell you another story from the Gospels, and this time we go to John 8, which is what we read earlier. And this is the last phrase, kept by God the Father, or kept by Jesus Christ, sorry, loved by God the Father, kept by Jesus Christ. And there's a picture there of a lady, and she's been caught in the act of adultery. Now, why was she committing adultery? We don't know, but there was something going on in her heart. Maybe it was the lie of, you know what, sex can really satisfy you. Maybe she'd bought into that lie, and so she's looking for satisfaction through sex. Maybe it's that she's searching for security, and in the arms of a man who appears to desire her, maybe she feels she'll find that security. Maybe it's she wants to be valued and to be told that she's worthwhile and she's desirable. And when she's with this bloke, she feels that. We don't know what was going on in her heart, but whatever was going on inside, it was strong enough and it was important enough that she would commit an act that she knew was wrong, because she needed to satisfy that desire, that foolish belief. Anyway, she's caught in the act, and what's the penalty for that? Well, it's death, according to the law. And there's a bigger story going on. These people who caught her, they're going to try to use her against Jesus. But that's not what I want to focus on. I want to focus on what it was like for her to have the door kicked in and to be exposed as being in the act of adultery, and then to be pulled out into public and for everyone to hear, hey, this woman, we just caught her sleeping with a guy, not her husband. The shame of that. And I guess the way for me to picture that for myself is, imagine if as I stood here before you, all of a sudden images flashed on the screens and a DVD had been put in, and somebody had managed to compile a DVD of my own fantasies. and a DVD of my worst words that you could hear, and a DVD of my worst actions that you could see, everything that was the very worst of what I had done, how I had acted on the internal desires foolishly, sinfully. Imagine if that was up on the screens and you were seeing it. What would I be feeling right now standing before you? Horrible. Absolutely horrible. And that was her experience right in that moment. She was incredibly vulnerable. Everything up on display for people to see. She has fallen short. She deserves condemnation. She deserves punishment. She deserves our scorn. And the people are like this, and like this. And what does Jesus do in the story? He bends down and writes. It's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So he bends down and writes. And the people are still there and they're waiting for Jesus to respond and say either, yes, she needs to die, or no, let's let her off. And either way, they'll know if he's obeying God's law or whether he's soft on it. And he stands up and says, now, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. And then he bends down and starts writing again. And I wonder if in that moment the penny dropped. See, I wonder if as Jesus was writing, he's put some different images up on the screen. And maybe he was writing different sins. And maybe they were thinking, oh, we didn't know she did that. Well, she did that. Oh, how dare she? But then maybe as Jesus stood up and said, now let him who is without sin cast the first stone, maybe the penny's dropped and they've gone, oh, this isn't just about her. This is about us. And yes, yeah, no, that's my sin on the screen right there. Yep, did that too. And all of a sudden we're all, what? Guilty. We're all in the same boat. And what do? They wander off one by one. And we don't know what they do with that. But they've come to realise, hey, I can't stand there anymore and say, that person is bad. That person is guilty. That person should be ashamed. We should do something about that person. Because Jesus has said, you know what? You're that person. We are all in the same boat. And if we knew everything that there is to know about each other, well, I'm glad I don't. Because that's just not nice stuff to dwell on. So what do we do with that? Well, we remember the fact that we are called. And what does Romans 5:8 tell us? It was while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. When the videotape showed all of the worst bits, that's when God said, I love this person. It's while the sheep was off in foreign country. It's while the coin was under the bed or wherever it was. That's when Jesus most clearly says, I love you, and that does not put me off. When Romans 8 says, what shall separate us from the love of God? The answer is not your sin. The answer is Jesus has paid it all, as a great hymn says. He's dealt with it. It is gone. You are loved and you are called. But not only is that the basis on which we're saved, that's the basis on which God keeps us. It's the basis on which we live. It's the basis on which we know that we will be there at the end. You see, even if I stuff up majorly, I can't lose my salvation. Because Jesus knew the very worst of me, even as he took it upon himself on the cross. Everything has been paid for. Nothing I do will lose what God has done for me. My hope is built on nothing less, not than Mike's own righteousness, than on Jesus' love and righteousness. He's the foundation on which we stand. And that's the grace of God for us. And it's true not only in terms of what we will get when Jesus returns and judges the world and we go to heaven or hell depending on what we've done with him. Not what we've done ourselves, what we've done with him, whether we've received it or not. But it's true in how we live day by day. You see, all of us can try to live on our own abilities. Now, I have the ability to live as a good person. I make good decisions. I do wise things, not foolish things. I have self-control. Guess what? Garbage. I cannot do it. And that's the introduction to Jude, where he's saying, you're called, you're loved, and you are kept, not by yourself, by Jesus Christ. If you're going to live righteously, if your life is going to be a blessing to others, if your life is going to be full of goodness instead of darkness, it completely relies on God. So stop trying to do it by yourself, as if you can earn God's favour and pleasure, as if you can make it by yourself. No, you need to come to God and say, God, I need you. I needed you to find me, and I need you to carry me, because unless you do, I have nothing. That's the whole essence of the Christian life. What does it mean for you this week to be completely reliant on the grace of God? Not to try and make it yourself, but to be completely reliant on him. That's where Chris used the illustration of a tank last week. And the fact is that God has given us every spiritual blessing in Christ Jesus, but it still is up to us to receive it. to put our attention on him, as Hebrews 12 says, fix your eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of your faith. That's how we run the race. That's how we throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. It's by fixing our eyes on Jesus. That's why we don't give up. So what would that look like for you this week, to rely completely on Jesus? It may be that you've been struggling with a persistent sin in your life and you're trying to overcome it, but you're just not getting there. And you're at that point where you need to say, you know what? I don't need to be afraid that this sin loses the love of God. I can actually own up and say, you know what? I need help, and know that God will give it to me. And one way that that might look for you is that you can come forward for prayer at the end of the service and say, you know what? I'm struggling with something. I would like your help. It might be a physical illness that you're struggling with and you just need God's help to endure it. Or you might ask God to heal you from it. It might be that there's that sin issue in your life. It might be a relationship that you just don't know what to do with. Whatever it is, you are not going to be able to sort this out yourself. You need God. So why don't you allow his people to come around you and pray for you, and allow his grace to be poured out into your life in that way? That's what the church is for. And that's what you have an opportunity to do today. It might be that you have not understood up until this point that, you know what, you can't be a Christian. You actually just need to accept the fact that God has done it for you. He's the one who died on the cross for you. He's the one who calls you to be in his family. He's the one who'll carry you through to the end. And you might, it might be the time for you to say, God, I just want to say, I receive it. I accept it. I want to be in your family. I'm not going to try to do it myself. I'm not going to try to live a good life by myself. I'm going to let you be in charge of my life, and I'm going to rely on you. And you might like to come forward as the service closes and just say, this is what I've decided to do. And we can rejoice with you and help you with the next step. Whatever it might be for you, don't reject what Jude is talking about here. You're called, you're loved, and you're kept by the power of God and the love of God. So receive that. Don't try to stand alone, because the Christian life does not work that way. Will you bow with me in prayer?